where does Medicare go from here? And who is to give the leadership? We thought we had answered that question, and we had scheduled a senator to speak to us because the Senate seems to have a major role to play on Medicare. But on October the 16th, Senator John Breaux was forced to cancel. And so then the question was, where should we go? And one of our friends made the point is that what was important was to provide an outlet for senior views. And on that basis, two people whom we had known before and heard of often seemed to be the logical people. Attorney Robert M. Hayes is president and general counsel of the Medicare Rights Center. He led the national and New York City coalitions for the homeless from 1917 to 1980 and practiced law with several law firms in New York and Maine, including Sullivan and Cromwell and O'Melveny and Myers. Just in case you want to know how the famous MacArthur fellowships were awarded, ask him. He received one. And he also has received 10 honorary degrees from 10 colleges and universities. He's a graduate of Georgetown and the New York University School of Law, and much more could be said. Marilyn Moon is somebody that's been at the head of our list from the beginning of our consideration of Medicare as a subject. She's president and director of health programs at the American Institutes for Research and is a nationally known expert on Medicare. She previously served as a senior fellow at the Urban Institute and is a public trustee for Social Security and Medicare trust funds. She's written extensively on health policy, both for the elderly and the population in general. Her recent publications include A Place at the Table, Women's Needs and Medicare Reform, and Stretching Federal Dollars, Policy Trade-Offs in Designing a Medicare Drug Benefit with Limited Resources. She also wrote a periodic column for the Washington Post on health reform. She's a program director for the Commonwealth Funds Program on Medicare's Future and served on a number of boards for nonprofit organizations and is the public representative both on Social Security and on Medicare trust boards. So without saying all the other things one could well say about them, Marilyn Monroe is going to kick off.
It would be nice if Marilyn Monroe kicked off, but it's going to be Marilyn Moon today.
The similarities are striking.
Well, I'm the opening act for Bob Hayes from the Medicare Rights Center, and it's a pleasure to be here today. Do I need to do anything to get this to stop echoing? It will stop in a minute. There you go. Okay. When we agreed to do this, I suspect Bob thought, but I certainly did, that there would be a Medicare prescription drug benefit package that would have been out and voted on. And we've certainly heard since June that this was happening imminently. All we had to do was get those two sides together and they'd make up their minds. And in fact, when the conference actually got started, it consists of all Republicans and just two Democrats at the moment who are allowed into the room, and it's still not possible for them to come to agreement on what to do about Medicare. So it's not clear at this point where we're going to go from here. So instead of talking about sort of what happens after a Medicare prescription drug benefit is passed, I'm going to talk a little bit today about whether it is likely to be passed and whether it should be passed. The first is very hard to say because we do not know whether or not some of the tough things that need to be decided can be decided by these conferees. And if they do, they run the risk of either alienating the more conservative members in the House of Representatives from whom they need support, or the more moderate members of the Republican Party and some Democrats in the Senate from whom they need support. So it's going to be a tough battle, and that's exactly what it appears to have been, mostly done behind closed doors, with little bits of secrets revealed, usually by the people that want them revealed all the time. So it's not the case that anyone is leaking that's a big scandal. They're essentially leaking to put the positions out on the table that they want to test in some cases, and in other cases to reassure people about either that they're moving in one direction or the other, and that seems to change depending upon whose help they seem to need. So I'm going to beg the question a little bit of whether or not this will actually come to fruition. Maybe Bob will take that up. I'm going to talk a little bit about some of the challenges in this legislation and what are things that need to be watched, whether or not it passes, because if it doesn't pass, some of these issues will come right back up again in the near future. And if it does, there'll be plenty of opportunity to revisit some of them. There are provisions, for example, in this legislation that would not start until 2010. So as a consequence, there's going to be a presidential election between now and then. And there are going to be two presidential elections between now and then. And a lot of opportunities for mischief to be made after this legislation is passed. Now, some people like me would probably argue that a little mischief is probably a good idea, because I have some real concerns about the legislation as we think it stands, or as outsiders think it stands, and where it might go if they take a certain turn in terms of this conference. But I'll say something good, and that is the House of Representatives, the President's, and the Senate have all committed themselves to spending $400 billion over 10 years on a prescription drug benefit for Medicare. That's a lot of money. It's a whole lot of money. It's an astonishing amount of money when you try to think about it in terms of your own budget. But it's less than a quarter of what older Americans and persons with disabilities who are on Medicare will spend on prescription drugs over the next 10 years. So as a consequence, when you think about it, that you only have about one-fourth of all of the drugs are going to be paid for in one way or another, you have to try to worry about how good a benefit you can design with that kind of a constraint. It's a very tough constraint. And in fact, some of the $400 billion will go to other things and not just to prescription drugs. Now, I suppose the good news about that is that it's a voluntary benefit, and we think that there are some people who will not sign up. Largely, the people who already have very good coverage through their former employers are unlikely to sign up for a prescription drug benefit unless the employer kind of nudges them into it. And there are some subsidies in this legislation to try to keep employers in the business, staying in the business of providing benefits to people who are currently getting them or will soon be getting them. One of the things that will happen, and you should watch if this legislation passes, is that there will be a considerable dropping of people with retiree coverage when it passes and goes into effect. But that is not to say necessarily that that would not have happened anyway. It will be a wonderful excuse for employers who are on the verge of dropping anyway. And it probably will change the timing a little bit, so that they'll speed that up over what they would have done. So instead of doing it in 2006 and 7 and 8, it might all occur in 2006 and then stabilize. So there will be some dropping, and people are worried about that. I actually think that it won't be as big as some people are anticipating, in part because if you provide subsidies to employers who are doing this voluntarily right now, why should they instantly run to the exits unless they think it's just a good excuse? They're going to hold on probably a little bit longer in some cases, or at least some of them are, if they get subsidies that help pay for this. Prescription drugs are now about half of the costs that former employers are putting up for health protection for former employees. The retiree benefit is almost, if not already, half for most of them. And it will grow over time, since prescription drug prices are growing faster than the rest of healthcare. So this is a very big deal for employers, and it's something to be concerned about and to watch over time. Because this benefit is voluntary, it means that other people will also just decide not to sign up. They don't think it's a good deal, or they're very healthy and they think they'll wait. Now, they're going to zap you a little bit if you do that, because they're going to penalize people for signing up late by charging higher premiums in the future. This is unknown exactly how they're going to do it. The Senate had a pretty good provision for doing it. The House had a pretty bad provision for doing it, allowing private plans to have a lot of discretion that would essentially have been allowed them to essentially underwrite you, which is not what you want to have done in a prescription drug benefit. So there's a real issue here in terms of how they would do a penalty, whether they would do it rather like Part B of Medicare is done now, in which you just pay an increased proportion every month if you, for every year you sign up late, or if it's going to be something that allows essentially insurance companies to turn you down when you sign up late or make it so expensive that you won't enroll. The other thing that they're doing to try to attract people while it's a voluntary benefit is put the benefits, some of the benefits up front. So that's why you see, even though there's a deductible in both of these bills, and there will be a deductible, I suspect, in the benefit package they report out, after that, you get coverage for a while that is either okay coverage, in the case of the Senate legislation, which would pay half, or quite good coverage in the case of the House, which would pay 80%. But the problem is they both stop at a certain point and they create what people in Washington have called the donut hole. I like to call it the Valley of Despair because it isn't really a full donut. It's really a dip in terms of the generosity of the coverage for people who are having chronic conditions and take, let's say, 3 or 4 drugs a day, every day. All year, those people are in the $5,000 range. So while, for example, the House starts gangbusters paying 80%, it only does so until you've spent $2,000. And then essentially when you go to the drugstore, they'll say you have no coverage for a while. The government won't pay anything until you've paid enough out of pocket to make up $3,500, and then it starts up again. So if you have $5,000 worth of spending, you will get 30% of your drugs covered under the House plan. Now, why did they do that? Well, it's not actually because they're incredibly stupid and they put forth a really bad benefit package, and it is a bad benefit package. It's because of 3 things. First of all, you're committed to no more than $400 billion over 10 years. Secondly, it's voluntary, so you want to have something up front so relatively healthy people will sign up and keep the costs low over time. And thirdly, you want to have some back-end protection for really high users, the people that spend $10,000 a year on drugs. So you start at the bottom, and you start at the top, and you kind of move down into your coverage until you run out of money. And that turns out to be actually where most of the growth in drug usage is, and that's for people that spend between $2,000 and $5,000 a year right now on prescription drugs, because they're folks with chronic conditions taking anti-cholesterol drugs, anti-hypertensive drugs, anti-ulcer drugs, etc. So if you are in that range, the protection is actually at its worst. It comes back up again. That's why I call it the Valley of Despair. You get good coverage in the beginning, you get a little coverage in the middle, and then you get better coverage at the end. So depending upon where you are, it looks good or not so good. That's going to be the thing that gets a lot of attention. But there are other pieces of this legislation that are also important that need to be looked at as well. And that is that there are a lot of things other than the coverage of drugs itself, one of which is who runs this drug benefit. The drug benefit, because of the bent of the people in the Congress who believe almost as religion that the private market will do better than the public sector, want the benefit to be provided only through the private sector. They want private plans to step up and offer drug benefits. One of the problems with that is that a couple of years ago when this was first proposed, the head of the Health Insurance Association of America said that was one of the dumbest ideas he ever heard, and none of his companies would be willing to do so. They've backed off from that a little bit, and they still are very nervous. And as a consequence, the legislation has a lot of protection against potential risks for for drug companies. But we still have drug companies that will be, I'm sorry, not drug companies, insurance companies that will be offering drug protection. Or it will be the PBMs that, if for those of you who are younger workers, probably are now covered for your drugs through a PBM, a pharmacy benefit management company. And the pharmacy benefit management company is the one that negotiates with drug companies to try to get lower prices and then tells you what drugs they'll cover and what drugs they won't cover. That's the way it kind of works right now for a lot of working people. That's the anticipation of how it will work as well in this particular framework for the Medicare program. One of the problems with that is that not only will they be free, these private companies, to offer different combinations of benefits, they can raise the deductible a little, they can lower the catastrophic protection, they can change the cost sharing, so they can manipulate that as long as it's actuarially in the same ballpark. That will be confusing enough, but they can also have different formularies. They can decide to pay for Lipitor as an anti-cholesterol drug, but not Provacol as an anti-cholesterol drug. They can cover Celebrex and not Vioxx. In some cases, that's fine, and it may make good medical sense, although most of these are not done on the basis of the medical sense. It's on the basis of which company is giving the biggest discount that month. And in some cases, Vioxx and Celebrex do very much the same things and may, and I'm drawing on them, and don't assume that I know what I'm talking about in terms of the side effects, but if they turn out to have very different side effects, that may be very important, and someone may not want to switch from Vioxx to Celebrex if and when there are important side effect differences between these brand name drugs, which happens in at least some drug categories. And to the extent to which that happens, then people are going to have to go out and shop on the basis of the formulary. But if you take Vioxx and Lipitor and a few other drugs, you're going to have to then figure out which of those drug companies has the best cost sharing, the best formulary, looks like it will stick with its formulary over time. It's going to be extremely confusing. And there's not going to be a lot of resources devoted to improving the information that people will need to make these good decisions. And Bob's group, who helps seniors, can talk a lot more about that issue in terms of the confusion that people run into. The other thing that will happen, and I'm only going to talk a little bit about this because Bob is going to pick up on it, we decided on the way down here this morning, and that is that in the enthusiasm for providing a prescription drug benefit, the thought is you can also move people towards other kinds of Medicare reforms, the most important of them being encouraging people to enroll in private plans, not just for their drugs, but for all that Medicare covers. Now, you can do that now through the Medicare Plus Choice program, but it hasn't worked very well. And in fact, a lot of the lessons from the Medicare Plus Choice program that seem to me should be lessons about being careful about competition have been pushed aside and said, that's because government is so bureaucratic and we haven't paid these guys enough. Well, we paid these guys enough. They just don't like what we're paying them. And so this legislation would essentially heap upon them substantial new payments before 2010 to encourage them to get into the market and be active, while not providing one thin dime more for traditional Medicare beneficiaries who remain in the mainstream program and, in fact, may increase cost sharing in other areas, creating what I believe would be an unlevel playing field. And then we will be primed for 2010, when the requirement will be that Medicare must be much more directly put in competition with these plans in a way that's different than today. All of these things are going to matter. The details matter a lot. They're not going to be discussed very much because everybody will be saying $400 billion for a new drug benefit, and it is important. It's a lot of money and may not be there in the future given the way that the deficit is going and the war in Iraq and a few other things right now, and shouldn't be dismissed or discounted, but a lot of the details are going to matter a lot, and a lot of people on both sides of the political aisle in good conscience are going to have to weigh whether or not they're going to vote for this legislation if it comes out. Why don't I turn it over to Bob?
Should we stand up? Actually, just to
I didn't go that fast.
No, you were great. The annals of introduction are always great, and this was a particularly a sweet introduction of Marilyn that I will continue to use as we go to other places together. But I got to say, my all-time favorite introduction of myself was back when I was doing a lot of work around the rights of homeless people, and a law student at the University of Ohio out in Columbus began this introduction, and now would like you to meet Robert Hayes, who in 1979 on the streets of New York City discovered the homeless. And thanks to his hard work, his tenacity, his intelligence, now not only are there homeless people in New York, but in Cleveland, Chicago, and Cincinnati. So Marilyn, that was not bad. I am a rookie, still learning much about Medicare and the healthcare wars from people like Dr. Moon. Advisedly, though, I did learn, returning to New York last year to take on this battle with the Medicare Rights Center, that they say New York is a city that never sleeps. We'll start talking about Medicare, and you tend to test that hypothesis. So I'm going to try to be brief. Marilyn and I both agreed that the most useful time for us to spend would be talking in dialogue to you folks and trying to help answer some questions with you. The importance of Medicare, as I've come to understand, is immense, not just to folks who obviously are either people with Medicare or on the brink of it. There's this great story from 1965, July 1965, when President Johnson was signing the legislation creating Medicare, and Max Frankel, who went on to run the New York Times, was a Washington correspondent reporting on the bill signing ceremony, and afterwards went up to President Johnson and said, "Mr. President, on behalf of my mother, I thank you for this bill." And President Johnson returned and said, "Mr. Frankel, don't thank me for your mother, thank me for yourself." The importance of that, I think, is something that we hear in the trenches of the Medicare Rights Center day in and day out, because basically what we do from that organization based in New York and Washington is reach out and try to help people understand what the health care benefits are all about and how to access health care when they can't get it. And whether it's older folks trying to figure out their own benefits, people with disabilities on Medicare trying to figure out to get care they otherwise can't afford, or whether it's children, or in some cases grandchildren, trying to cobble together a package of benefits, it's clear that this is indeed an intergenerational social reform that, as far as I can tell, may well be, despite the flaws that I'm sure we'll talk about this morning, one of the great social experiments of the latter part of the 20th century. The importance of it is sort of, in some ways, the product of my greatest frustration in understanding the politics of healthcare generally, and Medicare in particular, because there seems to be so little attention so frequently to the real life implications of the policy decisions, and so much zealousness and ideology, Marilyn used the term religion, in terms of some of the political decisions being made that affect day in and day out life. So I'm going to try to at least talk about one of the key issues, perhaps the most contentious issue remaining before this, I guess, rump group of congressional conferees trying to work out the Medicare overhaul bill, and try to put it in the place that we experience it at the Medicare Rights Center, which is hopefully not partisan, hopefully not ideologically, certainly non-sectarian, and do it from the sense that we receive about 70,000 calls from people every year. We take on about 10,000 cases where people, you know, call an 800 number and try to get assistance to fight through some kind of confusing question or some kind of bureaucratic blockade separating them from affordable health care. And we do it with a group of volunteers, largely. By day, we have many senior volunteers who come in, learn a lot. This is confusing stuff, you know, former securities lawyers and bank analysts. It's Medicare is complex. So we use those seniors frequently by day to help walk people through the thicket. In the afternoon, students come in as part of, you know, intergenerational projects, by and large. I'm even trying at night now to get, you know, sort of a single scene going with volunteers answering calls, and I want to get like a disco ball or something to just try to get more people, because we just can't meet the need to explain And we'll talk a little bit about the problem of confusion facing people who are trying to get health care. Marilyn touched on this. Clearly, the most contentious line in the sand that's being drawn by both sides of the ideological spectrum in Washington right now about whether there'll be a drug bill or not comes around an idea that is described in many different ways. Some people call this thing premium support. That is a system of privatizing Medicare so that we'll give a certain amount of money to folks with Medicare who can go buy then an insurance product, probably provided by private insurance companies. Others call that same concept a voucher system, kind of like the idea of, you know, forget the public schools, let's give parents vouchers to go buy education for their kids and let competition create better educational systems. Newspaper reporters of late, to my frustration, tend to describe this concept as a plan in the House bill that would require Medicare to compete in 2010 with private plans. Private plans meaning health insurance plans run in most cases by private for-profit corporations, although there are several nonprofit corporations as well in the mix. Why is this such a contentious issue? Because I have had a hard time figuring it out. Because after all, if you get rid of your religion on this issue, and you're in our business of trying to help people get the best health care they can get with the money that's available, competition sounds like a really good thing. Let's all figure out what works best. If traditional Medicare run by the government works best, God bless. Forget the religion. If private plans, if private corporate American can somehow, through the marketplace, create a better, more efficient product, terrific, let's go there. And people will know which direction to go. Despite that, despite the plausible, almost non-controversial view of letting competition work, this one issue seems to be the most likely collision that will prevent any bill to get through the Congress this year. So how come? It's because nobody, as far as I can tell, probably with the exception of Marilyn Moon, is willing to talk very clearly and openly about just what this debate is really about. Because it turns out it really isn't about competition at all. Here's what I mean. There is a well-founded view that Medicare is going to become more and more expensive as healthcare becomes more expensive and as more people demographically age into a Medicare system. There is also a view, and this is a view held by proponents of privatizing Medicare, of premium support, of the voucher system idea. These folks tend to take the view that Congress will never have the political will to significantly cut Medicare coverage benefits. Therefore, unless we figure out a way to do that in a viable fashion, there simply will be no Medicare left in this economy by mid-century because it will not be sustainable. Therefore, if, say, starting in 2010, we can begin having this kind of voucher system where people will be able to choose different kinds of complex, Marilyn hinted at how complex they can get, complex insurance packages, some of which will have benefits that will not be nearly as comprehensive as Medicare, people with Medicare become used to, maybe that's the way. Maybe add a little bit of fog, in a sense, to the consumer view, but maybe that's a way to get under control the potentially unsustainable costs of Medicare. And there's some truth there, because to be sure, Congress rarely shows profiles and courage when it comes to AARP and positions that they may take with respect to benefits. And there's also some truth there that we are facing a demographic challenge and a healthcare economic challenge at this point. Folks on the other side of this tend to say, well, look, we need to figure out a way to sustain Medicare, but tend not to say the next thing, which is how to do it. The criticism of the privatization of Medicare tends to be that at the end of the day, if we keep the same amount of resources in the system, people who can't add their own resources into the healthcare pocketbook are going to go without care who need it. And although, to be sure, there are some areas of Medicare spending that could be cut without hurting people, there's not a lot. And to be sure, although there are areas within Medicare spending, particularly if we get a drug bill, where better use of market power, like getting cheaper pharmaceutical prices in this country, might work to save some of the money to create a $400 billion package that could actually be of more benefit to people, that's probably still not enough. So mind you, a couple of years ago, I'm driving down the main turnpike, listening to the car radio, National Public Radio, and here, somebody who is on the board of this organization I just agreed to become president of, and they sounded like someone who I could not fathom having any political sense, because this person on the radio was actually saying, if we're going to have a decent healthcare system in this country, we're going to have to pay for it. We may have to really increase taxes, because otherwise we're going to cut benefits and people are not going to have the healthcare they need going into the next decade of this century. Well, that was Dr. Moon, who obviously is not going to be running for election in any near time, but was clearly pointing, at least honestly, the dilemma here, because the folks talking privatization are really talking about a way to be able to cut benefits in order maybe to shrink government, as some folks will describe it, or in order to sustain some level of Medicare system, as others would describe it. The notion of competition, though, some quick numbers, is one that is so appealing and yet so factually troubling. Here's why. Since, I guess, 1997's Balanced Budget Act passed by Congress, there has been a real effort, and this was sort of bipartisan, I suppose. This passed during the Clinton administration, so there's been both a Democratic and a Republican administration seeking to prod people with Medicare into private plans. In some parts of the country, Manhattan, for instance, there are private plans for people with Medicare that seem to have pretty good customer satisfaction. There are other places, like the state of Maine, where there's absolutely no private plans, because generally in rural areas there just is not sufficient economic incentive for a private company to go in. But what is that economic incentive? You know, competition? You use the term level playing field. That's normally, unless you're on the Washington Redskins these days, what competition is supposed to be. Why doesn't it work? Well, since this initiative that began in 1997 to bring private companies into the mix, we have been overpaying private companies at this point over 19% compared to what we're paying to cover folks with traditional Medicare. There's a 3% cushion in real dollars that these private companies are getting, and then there is an official Bush administration estimate that there's a 16.3% cushion provided, because folks who have been enrolled by private companies tend to be comparatively young, comparatively healthy, and therefore much less costly to cover. The reason I think people have come to agree why it at this point is not very efficient to provide Medicare benefits through private companies is because they are more expensive. The administrative costs are typically five times higher than traditional Medicare, number one. Number two, and this is the only like lawyer thing I'll say here, you know, if you're running an insurance company, you have a fiduciary obligation to your shareholders. You have to turn a profit. Whatever you say about the federal government and Medicare, they tend not to feel a fiduciary obligation to turn a profit back to taxpayers. So there is a need to add a profit motive to the privatization of a program like Medicare. And at the same time, the marketplace does sometimes work in healthcare, as far as I can tell. Marilyn can confirm or deny as an economist. But big purchases of healthcare tend to get better deals than fragmented purchases of healthcare. Hence, the Medicare system often can get a lower rate, call it fixed, call it bargained, with healthcare providers, with hospitals, with doctors, than private insurance companies. So all in all, the cost, the real cost, for logical reasons, is greater. The real costs historically during the last few years of experiment have been significantly greater, and the legislation that's now being considered in Congress, both the House and Senate bills, provide significant additional sweeteners to bring these private companies in. How come? again, to go back, it seems pretty clear because the folks who are championing this reform are not saying this really is a more efficient way of delivering services that will show the strength of competition. It's because over time, it's a politically viable way to get Medicare spending by lowering benefits accepted by the electorate. So what I think is good about coming to a place like this, at least 2 hours, with Maryland's driving 2 hours and 20 minutes away from Washington, is hopefully we can talk sort of honestly about this, because no one is getting elected in this room, at least not at this part of the table. It seems to me American consumers should have the right to at least understand what the debate is about. It is very complicated. Whatever bill comes out of conference will probably be 800 or 900 pages long, and that alone is going to make it sort of a test case for democracy. But even when the most contentious, most central issues being debated are basically being debated in code, it really puts the voting people, the people who are going to be most affected by this, at a very severe disadvantage. So, you know, at this stage, I just talking back that most of the people who I get to talk to about Medicare are still part of Tom Brokaw's greatest generation. They have not been at all eager to criticize the system on their own behalf. Increasingly, as more and more people with Medicare are the next generation, kind of in between the greatest generation who, you know, had their years of maturation during the Depression and the boomer generation of the post-war, the current generation moving into the Medicare system, it seems to me, are getting more and more ignited, again, not for their own sake, but recognizing that maybe President Johnson could have taken his retort to Max Frankel one step further, that, Mr. Frankel, you should thank me not just for yourself, but for your children and their children as well, because that's what the debate right now is all about.
Thank you. Our first questioner is not Carolyn Kennedy, but Carolyn Engelhard. So.
I think we're about the same age, probably a little older. Thank you both very much. Gosh, I have so many questions, but let's start where you ended, talking about the next generation. And my question is, at the risk of sounding naive, one of the things neither of you touched on, but I know you've written about, is this notion of a social contract and what that means in this country, what Uwe Reinhardt would say, who owes whom what in a civilized society. We don't hear anything about that now in the debate. Is it that we can't afford compassion, or that we just, it's just not playing well in these times?
I guess I think it's just not playing well in these times. If you talk about that, a lot of times the response from people will be, you're just talking about protecting yourself for now, the bill comes due later, and there is no sort of intergenerational compact because it's going to be broken by this the baby boom generation. When I look at the information that you can look at in this area and try to do relatively straightforward and simplistic but not optimistic projections into the future, as a society, we will definitely be better off on average. The next generation and the generation after that will undoubtedly experience substantially increased incomes. By 2030, for example, even when you control for inflation, a 50% increase in the level of well-being on a per-worker basis. So there's room there to share. But the problem is that it will be a bigger group that needs to be shared with. And economic growth can solve this problem in terms of enough resources, but it doesn't solve this problem with growth rapid enough, for example, to say that taxes won't have to go up, that other things won't have to change. And as a consequence, it does not play very well to talk about this social contract in some cases, because what you're saying is a bigger share will have to be paid by future generations to keep Social Security and Medicare going the way it is today? My answer to that is the pie will be a lot larger, and you can give a little bit bigger slice of pie when instead of being this big, it's that big. But it does mean people have to be willing to share, and that seems to be a very unpopular thing to talk about now because it kind of leads you down the path of taxation, which a lot of people are very unwilling to do. This is a program that actually has adjusted pretty well. Social Security, for example, has grown over time as our incomes grew faster. Even though it wasn't put on that trajectory, there were a lot of decisions made to share those resources over time. We don't know what future generations will do, but we like in the United States to not only dislike government, but to also dislike a sort of communitarian spirit. And I think that's partly why you don't hear as much of that discussion that way. It also depends on what group you're in. There are some groups in which that goes over very well, and others in which it doesn't.
We'd like to continue the discussion.
I would like to.
Please wait for the microphone.
We hear often in this debate about privatizing and competition, we hear about the government plan, which works so well. I don't know anything about the government plan. What is it, and how does it work, and does it work so well?
I understand, yeah. I'm going to say something about a government plan that does seem to work pretty well, and then turn to Marilyn to answer the second part, which is the federal employee program, okay? Because, you know, one of the dilemmas folks like myself have when you are kind of a critic is that you always talk about what's wrong with a Medicare system, because it does have so many gaps, and it is confusing, and it does leave people behind, and its rate paying is sometimes really bungled. That being said, I'm going to repeat something, because I think it's so easy to forget that it has been an amazing success story for much of the last 50 years. And even though in this era, we're not supposed to recognize too frequently government success stories, this really is one. Now, I'm not going to talk too much more about that, because my job is to be a critic. But Medicare is right now giving really decent healthcare coverage to 41 million folks, many of whom would be frozen completely out of healthcare coverage and would be dying without it. But then, Marilyn, there's a federal employee program that goes to the question.
Right. And the federal employee program essentially is structured such that the federal government negotiates with a range of plans and then offers them to the individuals who are in the federal government as employees, and they can choose among those plans. They pay a little bit more if they choose a more expensive plan. The government picks up a little bit more as well, for the most part. But the idea is that you make people aware that if they want a really expensive plan, they're going to have to pay more. I think that's what a lot of the folks who want to see competition have in mind. Make people pay if they want extras. But the interesting thing is that when people talk about how wonderful FEHBP is, they often forget to make all the distinctions. And they will say, FEHBP has wonderful benefit packages, it has prescription drug coverage, as if they arise poof out of competition. It's not the case. They arise because you have to be willing to pay for those kinds of extra services. To provide a benefit package comparable to FEHBP, which is what I think a lot of individuals think of when they hear this, say, oh, sure, I'd like to have a benefit package like that, because it is and has been a fairly good one, you would have to raise Medicare spending by over $1 trillion in the next 10 years. You would have to have about $800 billion to provide a drug benefit that's comparable to what people in FEHBP get, and you'd have to have another substantial amount to provide stop-loss protection that is upper limits on what you pay out of pocket, and reduce some of the other cost-sharing that's higher in Medicare than it is elsewhere. So ironically, when people hear different things when they hear this, a lot of people who say, yeah, FEHBP, that's not what people are really offering. They're offering, the proponents of this in the Congress are offering the structure, not the benefits. And the structure has some good aspects to it to allow people to pick and choose. One of the great difficulties has been, however, that Medicare is a program that takes everybody no matter what your health status is. And if you are a very good private plan and you have that fiduciary responsibility to your shareholders and you want to make money, which is a reasonable thing to do if you're a profit-making business, then you look for the easiest way to provide benefits to people that will give you a good profit and work well. And so far, the easiest way for private plans to do that is to pick and choose who they enroll. Now, they can't legally do that. They have to take anybody who signs up, but it's real easy to think of very clever ways. You have on the cover of your little magazine people playing tennis, and you offer health club memberships as inducements. That's actually illegal, but what you do is you call them rehabilitation services. You have higher cost sharing for people who need home health copays, for example. You have per day amounts that people have to pay when they go in the hospital. So sick people very quickly get the idea that this is not the best plan for them. It also means that individuals who have a predilection, especially once they're older or disabled, to know that they have health conditions that require them to see physicians. They're likely to have multiple physicians, and less likely than a 30-year-old healthcare legislative aide on Capitol Hill to say, I'll take a chance on fly-by-night HMO because its premiums are really low, and heck, I'm healthy anyway, and I don't have a doctor. If you've got three doctors that you count on, chances are they're not all in one of those private plans. So individuals also don't tend to go into those private plans who have health problems. We have not figured out a way to do a good job of then paying plans or private traditional Medicare enough to compensate for these differentials. If we could, then this would probably work pretty well. The believers in this system say, assume a risk adjustment mechanism and it will all be great. The problem is, it's a little bit like if you know economists, you may have heard the old saw that economists like to assume things that aren't really there, and the economist stuck on a desert island, and like the physicist trying to figure out a way to get his can of beans open without a can opener, the economist starts with, assume we have a can opener. Well, and one of the problems here is it's assume we have a risk adjustment mechanism. Now, people will say FEHP, BP doesn't have one, and it does not. And it works pretty well, but it works pretty well because people are largely healthy and don't know when they're going to be sick. There's a lot more uncertainty about how expensive you're going to be when you're younger. And it's not true that it hasn't caused problems. There is no longer a high option Blue Cross Blue Shield plan because it went out of business because it got so expensive that it was way out of line with everything else because everybody just kind of ends up with the same types of benefits. And it's also the case that it was filled with older persons who were afraid to change plans, which is also another issue. That's a long answer to your question, but you punched my button because FEHBP is potentially a model, but people have to understand what it is they're actually comparing it to.
Next question.
I'd like to ask why anybody thinks Medicare is doing a good job now with the things it does pay. For example, you get a $69 doctor's bill, Medicare's impenetrable bureaucracy will pay maybe $23 of that, always much less than half. So the result is the doctor is grossly underpaid and a larger proportion of cost is thrown on people who don't have Medicare. What's good about that?
You want to go first?
Sure. Sometimes that happens, but let me give you my example in downtown Washington. I go to a physician who no longer takes any insurance except Medicare. She charges me $75, which I think is cheap in downtown Washington for about a 20-minute visit. Medicare would pay $58.46, I think. She showed me her payment at one point. And my insurance company, because I'm going out of network, says that it's worth $32.10 and pays 80% of that. There is cost shifting from Medicare onto the private sector in some places, but not in this case. Medicare is a much better payer than a lot of private plans these days. And as a consequence, the difference, though, between what Medicare would pay and what my insurer pays is I pay the full difference. In Medicare's case, you still are protected in terms of how much you as an individual have to pay. When Medicare falls behind, we get a lot of political heat, and we tend to see payments to doctors go up. A big chunk of money out of this $400 billion will go to paying higher Medicare physician fees if it passes this fall.
Yeah. You know, and to me, just to briefly follow up, one of the questions of evidence versus mythology troubled me around this very issue because, you know, not only am I a lawyer, but I have a bunch of, like, physicians in my family, and I can't go to, like, any family event without getting attacked now that I work for the Medicare Rights Center. And the attack is, how many physicians here? Just so I know how vulnerable I am. Okay, here we go. Okay, so help me on this. Last year, the AMA, American Medical Association, successfully lobbied the Congress to shift a physician payment formula to result in an increase, not a decrease, as was planned in physician payments. And I took a lot of started paying a lot of attention to this when I saw some of the lobbying materials being disseminated by the AMA, was citing some reports the Medicare Rights Center had done, because you remember we're a consumer group. You know, we think we are in league with healthcare providers because we want them to be paid fairly so that they are happy providers to our patients, our consumers, our constituents. So we tried to, you know, start figuring out exactly, you know, whether this was a problem of what was called access. And we were getting scattered reports from around the country. We were talking a lot to people on our consumer advisory board like Gene Smith here. We were going out to organizations around the country that get consumer helplines going and said, you know, is access a problem? And at first blush, we got a lot of positives and went back and started pressing, were physicians not seeing people with Medicare because of the Medicare payment rate? And one by one, it seemed as we followed up, it tended to be that folks' practices were not seeing new patients, period, or not seeing new patients who had insurance, Medicare, or private. And as I've started doing this focus group of my family members who are physicians, it seems the only way to get them to stop complaining about the Medicare payments is to get them to start talking about the private insurer payments, because even though in some cases, you're right, the Medicare rate is lower, the reliability and the speed of Medicare payments tends to net more in practices than not. So I'm still sort of agnostic on this, to be honest, but we could not find evidence to support the notion that the Medicare payment rates were hurting people and keeping doctors' offices closed from them. So I'll raise that as a question back. Yeah.
Brief question, yeah?
Well, the fact that the law as it was written before the recent revisions would have provided for progressive reduction of fees over the next 5 years. Mm-hmm. To fees which were approximately those by 26, I guess, approximating the fees back in 1993. So it was not only the current change which was at issue, but the future changes which were really devastating. So I don't know what the participation might have become. Yeah. Although I suspect you're right that there's more noise in the system than there is action.
Well, we're watching closely.
Can I ask a question now? This, like Carolyn, I don't know where to start, but one of the things that is clear to me is that private plans run a much higher cost than the Medicare program. The Medicare administrative cost is roughly 3%, I believe. Mm-hmm. I've been on the board of an HMO for profit. Didn't make any, but our costs, I'm sure, were in excess of 20% because of the marketing people that we had to have and the actuaries we had to hire and so forth. The costs are much higher. I don't really understand how anybody thinks that private insurance can compete in the Medicare age group with a public good. It just seems to me to be a pie-in-the-sky arrangement. And I can tell you that we dropped Medicare Plus Choice, not because they weren't paying us enough, but because they couldn't get their act together. They were giving us figures in April for the payments we were going to be receiving 18 months later, or actually 21 months later. And that, in an inflationary environment, that was impossible. So I really don't see how they can compete with a government program.
Well, the evidence indicates that they don't compete very well with a government program, and that's one of the difficulties in figuring out how to use this. My guess is if you could do it over a very long period of time, you would actually see Medicare and private insurance track each other relatively well with ups and downs, because as I said, Medicare has been relatively responsive when it realizes it's gone too far in things. And the interesting thing about the physician payment issue is that it was based on a really badly created formula that was created by our U.S. Congress, but it was on the assumption, first of all, that GDP would continue to go up, so it zaps you if GDP doesn't go up, and on the assumption and penalizes physicians if the volume of use of care goes up, and didn't take into account the fact that when all these people flooded out of Medicare HMOs and back into traditional Medicare, then use of physicians would go up. So there's an interest in solving that problem so it doesn't stay on this downward trajectory. But again, it's a question of money, and no one wants to put a crowbar in their wallets for this, because to solve that problem, my understanding is it's in the $60 to $70 billion range.
Next question. Yes.
Actually, a tripartite question. Can you speak at all to the demographics of the people who need the prescription drug benefit? I mean, who are they? What kind of income levels they have? Those kinds of things. And I ask that question in reference to the fact that I see personally coming down the road a lot of boomers who are going to be on Medicaid for long-term care, which is going to have an enormous drain on a Medicare budget. And then my final and favorite question is, how do we handle these kind of things when we have open borders?
You take the first two, I'll take the last.
The demographics of people who need prescription drugs are pretty much as you would expect. As you get older, there's an increase, although when you get really old, it drops off because people stop taking some of the... I think legitimately there's a notion that if you've made it to 85 and your cholesterol is high, you know, go for it and stop taking those drugs. And sometimes it's because we have a tendency to have probably inappropriate age discrimination against people who probably could live longer and healthier than they do if they get some care. The notion that we spend lots on people at the end of life is really a myth. But we're increasingly where we're spending most of the money is on chronic conditions. And a lot of that begins at age 50. If you look at the use of drugs, it kind of perks along, and then suddenly at about age 50, it takes off. So the baby boomers ought to be very interested in this issue. And they will come in being big-time consumers of drugs and expecting that kind of protection. It's also the case, though, that a lot of lower-income individuals have high drug needs. Some of them are now protected by Medicaid. But the people that are really kind of stuck are the folks who are going to be a little bit above the ability to get special low-income protections, but not with enough income to really make it well. If you've got $15,000 a year of income as an older person, for example, you won't get any low-income protection. But if you're spending $4,000 a year on drugs, it's going to continue to be very expensive for you. So we have not done a very good job of targeting that. We might try to target it better, but then I think we would try to target it fairly generously to people with lower incomes if we did that. Future costs are going to be expensive. Cross your fingers and hope that one of these drugs that comes along really does cure Alzheimer's, and then all bets are off. That could have an enormous difference in the cost of health care. One of those things that may not happen ever, or in 20 years we may say, what fools people were to think that long-term care was going to be needed to the extent to which we think it will be now. So it's really hard to know, but it's going to be around with us for a long time. Full employment for me till I retire.
Maybe to go to your third question, which I think brings us almost full circle to Caroline's initial question, frankly, which is open borders and what is the social contract? Because as far as I can tell in healthcare, that is the great unasked question and clearly an unanswered question. You know, back in the 80s when I was going around the streets of American cities, you know, trying to get folks to pay attention to homelessness, it really wasn't so hard because there was sort of, at least for a time, a visceral reaction that there's something wrong about letting people go without survival resources in an affluent society. I don't get quite that same feel or the same kind of public recognition going around now talking about the healthcare crisis. I think part of it is probably because there's a good deal of eye aversion to something that you really can very easily not see other people facing in terms of going without fundamental healthcare. At some level, I guess we'd have to get a clinical definition of at what point is healthcare a survival resource, get the economists to figure out what it would cost, and how you make a dividing line, which we do quite well now with Medicare and Medicaid in terms of people who are legally entitled and people who are not, but how when we have, if not open border, a porous border, and we have people who have saved and been very careful to make sure they had a nest egg to pay those extra premiums in healthcare in their old age and those who haven't. How you deal with that, I think, is a question that I almost never hear talked about. And, you know, I, you know, will be second to no one in being sanctimonious and moralistic, and I don't hear it, so I doubt if many other people do. So I welcome the question from both of you, and I worry about it because I think we're not ready to approach it with any kind of responsible fashion.
But could I also just add, when we think about immigration into the United States, look at healthcare workers in the United States now and the enormous proportion of immigrants that are serving the needs, particularly and the less skilled needs of seniors and persons of all ages in healthcare.
And the reason our demographics give us a chance to be able to go into the rest of the century, unlike most of Western Europe, is because of the open, porous borders that are bringing youthful working people into the country. And we will not have the same aging demographic that France and Italy are already facing in this country. Yeah.
Before adjourning, we were not able to include one announcement. One of the most popular and widely respected commentators who over the years at the Miller Center has been Kevin Phillips, and he'll speak on his new book on McKinley, takes another look at President McKinley, Kevin Phillips, on November 19th at the Miller Center. We want to thank you for a very clear and forthright presentation, and we hope you'll come again.